Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a couple of representatives of the Novartis company. This is a big pharmaceutical giant, in fact, that runs across the scope of biomedical treatments. They look into vaccines, they look into medications, small molecules, big molecules, biologics, as they're called. And we've got two representatives of that company today, not to talk about the company per se, but about drug development, epidemiology, and things of that nature. So, Russ, who are our guests today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Brigitte Tadmore. She's a VP, and also with her is Amory Johnson, and he's a director. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
And as usual on the program, before we actually get into what it is that you really know and what your responsibilities and expertises are, we'd like to know a little bit about you both. So, Brigitte, tell us a little bit about how did you get into science?
I liked it. I was good at it.
That was enough. Amory?
Yeah.
Any different?
I think naturally I'm more of an artist, but I was intrigued by science. My father's very scientific, and so I was compelled towards it, but it wasn't like my strength. But I liked it so much that I wanted to do it. So I ended up finding a discipline that kind of melded my love for solving problems with science, which was epidemiology. So there's kind of an arts and a science component to it, and that's what drew me to epidemiology.
Okay, so by arts, you're sort of liberal arts, sociology, as opposed to just drawing.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the basic sciences, but right. It wasn't a strength. I mean, I was a regular B student, sometimes not so B. But I liked it. I enjoyed it. It wasn't like something I was like, oh, God, I have to go to this class. I liked it. It wasn't my strength, but I knew there was something that I could mesh with it that it would allow me to do it, and that's what epidemiology allowed me to do.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm also always been interested in the interface between art and science, so I understand that. And maybe you have some experiences or secret ambitions there. I noticed that there was a woman recently that's made an individual flower for each element in the periodic table.
I might not be on that level, but otherwise, it'd be interesting to see what she did. Yeah.
Okay, so both of you then, you work for the same company, Novartis, and they're a big drug development company. So let's talk a little bit about where we are today in terms of the need for new drugs, new treatments for diseases that we have. How does a company even begin to know where to concentrate? There's so many diseases, so many possibilities. How do you think about how you focus? Brigitte.
Yeah, so we have actually a very clear guidance there, but you are right that it's clear in terms of we go after medical need. So wherever there is a disease with a big unmet medical need, we select it then really by whether we understand the science. And I think that's where you can start prioritizing, because there are clearly a lot of diseases out there where people suffer from, where we would want to help, but we don't have, not just we as Novartis, but the science in the world just isn't there to have at least a reasonable chance to come up with some sort of effective treatment or a vaccine or whatever you are trying to do.
I can remember one in particular that I know. One of my children suffered from juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and there wasn't really much of a clue of what this disease was in terms of how to treat it. They wanted to give him iridium complexes, gold complexes. There's a whole plethora of looked like black magic to me, and so that wouldn't be one of the areas that you would go after, because anyway, arthritis is a mixture of diseases, I believe.
Yeah, it is. But just because something is rare or mysterious doesn't mean, if we start thinking and wrapping our arms around that, we wouldn't be figuring it out. But sometimes there is also the other element. I mean, I think when you talk from an industry perspective, some of those more mysterious or rare disorders, they have not been tackled because there was a perceived lack of market size. And that's not a criterion we are using, but I think typically in industry that has been used. So your child may have been suffering from
a
disease.
You don't want to go after the five cases in the world
of
this very strange disease.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Wasn't Novartis a startup some time ago? Can you give us a little history?
We are not quite a startup, but we are
now,
in a way.
You're not,
yeah, yeah.
But,
well, it's interesting because it's an old company that's a Swiss that came out, a bunch of mergers that came from the chemical area, really chemical specialty industries, and then moved into pharma sometime mid last century. And we are a startup in a sense that in the year 2002, we took out research and set it up as a different entity within the company and set it up much more as a dynamic entrepreneurial biotech company than a typical pharmaceutical research organization.
When people think of Novartis, what particular drug would you point to as being one of your more successful ones over the years?
I think one of the drugs that shaped us internally as well as, you know, for which we are known externally is Gleevec, which is a drug for chronic myelogenic leukemia, which is a very aggressive form of leukemia. It's not one of the most common forms of leukemias, but it's a very aggressive form where it became clear from a molecular mechanism what's wrong with it. And so we were able to find what's as close as a cure as you probably ever get in a disease.
So you would say that the cure, and I didn't really know
it's
that
it's not
there
a cure, but it's a
treatment.
A treatment, yeah.
But I think what I heard you say was that you sort of understood the mechanism and you designed something to address the mechanism binding to a cell or something.
It was not to a cell, but we understand on molecular level what goes wrong in that particular disease and can target then very specifically the kind of molecule that got messed up in that disease.
And is it a genetic disease?
It is genetic in the sense not genetic like you inherited from your parents, but it's something that occasionally we have genetic mutations that are called somatic mutations that can happen spontaneously in any part in your body. And that particular in leukemias you often have where you have a mutation in one of your blood cells. So it is a genetic alteration, a somatic genetic alteration.
But it's not one that's based upon any racial makeup. I mean, Anglos,
no.
Hispanics, African-Americans,
no.
It's all around the world.
It's around
very,
the
very
world.
Very rare.
It's rarer than other forms,
right.
Yeah.
And now you've got this particular drug you mentioned. And what's the prognosis then for someone that's discovered with this disease today?
Again, the drug was approved in the beginning of this century, and patients live with the disease. And it's not the chemotherapy that you have where you suffer from the treatment. It's not one of these generic things that kill you as you go through these treatment regimens. It's
okay.
A drug that's very targeted towards a molecule that's...
But it's a drug you have to continually
that
take.
That you have to continuously
take. But just
take.
For our audience, leukemia is, just define the disease a little bit. Too many white blood cells or not enough white blood cells or...
Something goes wrong in that mechanism.
And so you identified something wrong, and then you have a drug that actually attacks the problem, keeps it under control.
Yeah, it keeps it under control. You have, let's say, something divides too often and grows too much, and you hold that process.
So, but this is one of the examples then where people had studied the cause of the disease, and then knowing the mechanism, if you like, of the disease, you were able to make a drug that was
a targeted drug
right.
treatment.
So this is a multidisciplinary team. I mean, you need the people, first of all, the epidemiologists to find out where it is, find out that it's a mutation, and then find the drug. So, I mean, how do you do that in Novartis? Is there some special trick that you have of interdisciplinary teams?
I think the industry has learned there are no tricks. We have to work it out, each organization in their own way. And I think certainly that drug was discovered as a team effort, but like any other drug, I think at this point we need to organize ourselves in interdisciplinary teams around any type of disease.
How do you? Because all institutions, even universities, well, we're just building a new $90 million chemistry department, and we're told, well, it's going to be 70% occupied by chemistry and 30% by some other group because they want to foster interdisciplinary activity.
Yeah.
But the labs will still be separated. The offices will still be on different floors. What is Novartis's approach to interdisciplinary research?
So we really try to more and more give ownership to a interdisciplinary team who works on a particular drug project. So it's not that the chemists do some work and then they hand it over to the biologists or to the pharmacologists, and then those would hand it over to the clinicians. But we are trying to have at any stage in the drug discovery process the multiple disciplines represented and give input or at least understand what the team is trying to accomplish.
Remember, you were telling me that there's actually a lab design concept there. Instead of having boxes with different people in it, you sort of have the labs mixed Could you talk about that a little bit? Who designed that? I mean,
so when you try to foster team environment, I mean, organizationally, you need to set it up in a certain way and how people report and who makes decision and all that. So from an organizational perspective, we are trying to address that. And then what you're talking now is more the kind of environment, the physical environment, where now we are talking how you design buildings, how you design lab space.
Do you actually have chemists and biologists at the same bench?
And we do actually have now our newer labs in the buildings in Basel and some of the labs that we are building in Shanghai in China, where we literally have chemists and biologists mixed in the same lab.
And they don't fight over who gets the hood next?
Or? We'll see.
So this is an adventure that you're still in the process.
At the moment, they are told to work together, and we'll see where that goes.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you have kids and you create a particular structure. I'm not saying that our scientists are children. Now, don't get me wrong on that.
But a lot of us are very childish.
Yeah, we are.
But the whole point is when you create a structure that allows people to do something that we know needs to be done inside of our company to be as innovative as we can be, they can begin to behave in that way and see that it's beneficial to them. And that's what I think the way that we're designing our workspaces is going to allow our scientists to do.
Let's talk about that a little bit because, well, let me preface this by a comment of my own experience. When I started out as a very junior faculty member in England, I remember I had to go to a meeting that ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, put together. Mm-hmm. They were very upset about the lack of creativity in their new PhD incoming classes. They just said, you know, they're all, I don't know what the expression was, but they thought they lacked creativity. So they brought us all together, different groups of people, high level, junior level students, and said, now, make yourself comfortable in the room. It was a tea group, an encounter group. And I remember sitting on a windowsill. I thought, hey, that's a good place to sit. And then they asked us to go and have dreams and come back. So this is 30, 40 years ago. Is there still, from your perception then, incoming scientists, are we training them still the wrong way, that they're very technically competent but somehow lack a little bit of imagination?
Well, it's not just the imagination. I think certainly we put a lot of emphasis on the technical competency and abilities and capabilities. By the way, and it's not just how we train students, it's in our own organization how we select talent. We typically look at the resume in terms of, you know, where the person published, what kind of techniques they know, what kind of classes they took, and, you know, how well they did. So we are assessing often talent much more on the basis of their technical competency than on some of the other skills that are so critical for the success.
You know, Roald Hoffman wrote about this. And what he said when he picked a research student was he wanted to see that somewhere in that record, that student had taken a risk. And I know we used to do that, too, back at Exxon. We'd send them into the lab. These are from best schools in the world. And sort of get them to hang around with some people. And if they came back and say, we'd say, do something useful to the company. If they came back in 6 months and said, what do you want me to do? They went down. It was the people that would take risks and try something. And how you make that distinction is not always easy from the academic record.
Yes. No, it's a very hard. And I mean, I think it's something that we often discuss internally as you are diversifying your workforce. It's not just a discipline. I mean, we know we need a chemist or a biologist, but it's sort of the other things, the broader skill sets that we want, different problem-solving skills, different mm-hmm. perspectives. Those are very difficult things to assess in a process of hiring a person.
So then when Novartis, that started in Basel, Switzerland, and now moved to the United States, that is going from a society which, if I can say it, is relatively homogeneous. Into a society which is anything but homogeneous, North America.
Yeah.
And that very diversity of North America is both once its Achilles heel, and yet it's great strength and into the future. So how does diversity fit into the plans of Novartis and other companies like that? How do you take advantage of diversity in North America?
It's critical. I mean, we believe that it is critical as we become truly global as a company. It's critical for both from a perspective of innovation, as we just discussed, people with different skill sets, problem-solving skills, perspectives are likely as an organization. You are better performing, you are more innovative, more creative. for us, it's also critical because we believe people who come from different cultural, ethnic groups, they are more sensitive and aware of some of the health disparity issues that exist. And with that, I mean, from a pharmaceutical company's perspective, we definitely need to understand the sort of the biology, the differences in disease predisposition so that we can develop drugs that work.
And the sociological background of that group of people.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Kinnelly, and our guests today are Brigitta Tadmore and Amri Johnson, both from Novartis, a big pharmaceutical company. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Even though the flu season arrives yearly, certain spots in the U.S. can still end up short on flu vaccines.
That's because the long production process necessitates a set supply, and manufacturers can't respond quickly enough to sudden spikes in demand.
But an experimental new approach may create a flu vaccine that's easier to produce and possibly more effective. Researchers fuse the common protein with a part of the flu virus to create a nanoparticle that's better than the current flu vaccines at generating strong immune responses in mice.
The protein called ferritin is normally used to store iron. Researchers discovered the protein can self-assemble so that 24 ferritins form a spherical molecule with a hollow core.
Then they took another protein, this time from the flu virus called the hemagglutinin, or HA. It's on the surface of the virus as spikes. When researchers mix the ferritin and HA proteins, a new complex forms so the ferritin's spherical core possessed 8 HA spikes.
This nanoparticle looks a lot like the natural virus. It stimulated the animal immune system to produce flu antibodies that were more than 30 times higher in mice and 10 times higher in ferrets compared to the current vaccine.
Even though the vaccine was made using the HA protein from a flu virus from 1999, it could protect against flu strains from 2007. Normally, traditional flu vaccines only work against that year's viral strains.
This suggests the vaccine has the potential to provide multi-year protection against families of flu viral strains. Eventually, this could lead us to a universal flu vaccine.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Kinnelly, Brigitta Tadmore, and Amri Johnson. And we were talking about how diversity in North America is going to be one of our key strengths into the future. And in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, it's something of paramount importance because there are, in fact, many genetically based diseases. And there are sociological differences in different subsections of the population. So let's go to Amri here. How do you hope that that's going to play out in your company? How are you going to maximize the potential of diversity in America?
Well, I think first we have to look at diversity in a way that doesn't restrict us to the definitions that we've historically seen. You know, we usually break them down into, you know, race and ethnicity, gender, and sometimes, you know, sexual orientation has come into that. But there's so many other dimensions, and even the way that you solve problems, the way you innovate, the way you think about something based on your background and bringing that perspective to the table. And Brigitta talked about perspective and really how can we get people at the table that have different perspectives. Now, some of that perspective is driven by your background and by where you come from and the experiences that you've had. But in and of itself, some of it's just a matter of who you are and what interests you. And your interests differ based on your experiences, your identity, as well as your scientific interests. So we hope that we pull people together with that variety of interest, and they come to the table and they can actually, you know, have a rigorous or a vigorous debate about how things should be done and then land on solutions, not necessarily just one, but enough of them that they have things to select from. And if they have to choose one, they can say, you know, the best idea out of this group of ideas can rise to the top and be executed on.
Do you need a special training of people in order to bring them to that particular position? Or, you know, if you put all these people in a room, I can see sometimes it's rather chaotic.
Absolutely. It's not easy.
Chaotic tension.
Yeah.
I mean, diversity leads to a lot of clashes and misunderstandings.
Well, give us an example of within your experiences and Brigitte's the boss and Amory's the second boss. Give us an example of where a confrontation, I don't know, that may be the wrong word.
Not between us.
No. Okay. Of course not. No,
let's be clear.
Let me get that clear. Right.
We never disagree.
Beautiful. But where you've had such a meeting and the tensions have come up, how do you handle it and what's a good success that you've had?
I'm not sure whether I can come up with specific examples, but you certainly see, you know, when a group of scientists, let's say, comes to a decision board that makes a decision about what's the fate of a particular project, the emotions are very high because many, many hours of work, if not years, have gone into that work. And so when you then don't engage the decision makers and there isn't a discussion and people do feel their ideas didn't raise to the top, you sort of maybe walk away like with a challenge or that something was launched that the scientists knew would not succeed, but they were not listened to. And so I think we can have this kind of scenario in our own organizations where the decision boards are often the more senior people who are used to know it and make the decisions, who not always listen as carefully as we would want them, to the teams very often carefully thought through recommendations. Mm.
Just to add to that, it's also being aware and reflective on how you're making the decision. Like, we have a certain mechanism, so almost subconsciously or implicitly, that says when we see this, we respond this way. And so it gives you an opportunity, and what we want to be able to encourage is to be reflective of how you make those decisions kind of from the gut, mm-hmm. Because your gut decision isn't always the decision that's going to give you the most broadest range of possibilities for something that's more dynamic than you might have had in the past because you're accustomed to that thing in the past. You keep selecting it.
So you must have some sociologist, psychologist, or somewhere in this type of meeting to sort of help steer the conversations?
Not really, but I think, you know, we do have people, including Amory and myself. I mean, although he's an epidemiologist, I'm a geneticist by training, we today work on organizational issues. I mean, our experience came to that point where we help advise the organization, not on the science. We don't get involved in scientific decisions at the moment in our roles, but we do help the organization on processes around it, and process not in a sort of anti-innovation sense, but to structure how an organization really works and operates.
You know, there's an example of this discussion that we used to run into at the lab I was in, and that was the difference between the plan. So you had some manager, and there was the plan, and everybody was sticking to the plan, and this terrible thing called serendipity. And there was a lot of people that just couldn't deal with something happening serendipitously. They would say it's luck or whatever like that, that changed the direction. To me, and when I saw this really good research going on, there was an ability of the management to see that serendipity would take it in a better direction, and the heck with the plan.
I'd say we have it, and I think most scientists, when they see it, are excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, whoa, if we have scientific understanding of that serendipity and it comes at a place where people can talk about their understanding and we can advance it, I think that's an ideal situation for us, because I don't think you can have a set plan in the process of scientific discovery.
Well, we had a lot of engineers, too. That made a difference. I know we're getting short on time. I wanted to ask you another question. Here in El Paso on the border, diabetes is a big problem. Type 1, type 2. I have a granddaughter that's type 1. Could you talk a little bit about that? Are you working on diabetes? And the reason I'm asking that question is I know that a lot of the literature is now saying it's an autoimmune disease that can be actually cured by suppressing the agent that's causing the reaction.
So you mentioned, I mean, you make the distinction between diabetes 1 and diabetes 2.
One is autoimmune, yes.
And these are really two very, very separate diseases. So when we talk about diabetes 1, yes, the understanding is that this is an autoimmune disease. And we are actually at the moment we are committed to both forms of diabetes, by the way. But in diabetes 1, we are having some compounds that are active in other autoimmune diseases that we are testing in diabetes 1.
That's an interesting point, because many diseases that to us as lay people look very distinctive, in fact, form, when you look further back, a family of diseases.
That's right.
And so that's a particular area of research that must be quite exciting, because there's a possibility of going to the core and then stopping a whole series. So I got one question on that. I know in Iceland they have this tremendously good database where they've gone over generations and generations of families looking at the diseases that crop up within families, and now being able to do a genetic profile that says, hey, there's something in this genetic feature that will lead to the following diseases. So I've made a lot of comments there. Comment on my comments, please, Brigitte.
I actually want to go back to the comment you made about diseases that the layperson thinks are not related, that we do understand from a molecular point of view are actually very related and, in fact, share a similar mechanism. And it is very much, you know, our strategy to understand and go after these common mechanisms that are shared by many diseases. And the flip side of that is what laymen think is one disease is often not one disease, so that have just the same clinical symptoms. So arthritis is not one disease. Many cancers or breast cancer is not one disease, but many, many subsets of diseases. And it really cuts both ways, that on the one hand, things that look have no relationship are really related on a molecular level and therefore can be treated by one and the same drug, maybe different, you know, treatment regimen. While sometimes when we think we have one disease, we know that not everybody is going to respond because they have a different type of disease, just the same symptoms.
So do you have one particular story you can tell where you've been able to go to the root cause of several diseases with one drug?
Yeah,
or one treatment?
I mean, because it's sort of our approach there, I think our first series of diseases that we are treating with one drug is in the family of interleukins, and we are treating there first a very rare genetic disorder that is a inflammatory disease, and then we are testing the compounds in many, many other compounds and many other diseases like arthritis, like gout, like diabetes. But we first brought it to the market on a series of rare diseases that you and I have never heard the name of them and probably don't know anybody who has the disease.
Would you say that was somewhat serendipitous when we actually looked at that particular disease, Brigitte?
No, I think that was sort of clinical insights into those rare diseases that share some similarity in how the symptoms are coming about. Mm.
And in fact, we've got to finish, but I just wanted to finish on a note that I found interesting when I was researching this. That is that Novartis actually has a sort of a subset of your activity looking at those infectious diseases, which are sort of, what's the word that we use, neglected diseases.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that is a socially important feature of Novartis.
Yeah, we do have a huge commitment. We have an institute in Singapore that's committed to develop drugs for so-called neglected diseases. And I think what we have learned as a pharmaceutical company, the commitment to the research is actually the easy piece. The one that becomes then really difficult is how you manufacture and distribute and bring it to the patients in the developing world. And often there you need to work with governments, with local NGOs, with the local infrastructure. So it's actually a huge challenge.
I believe it. It's a huge challenge to stop this program because there's a lot of more things we could talk about. But Brigitte Tadmore and Amri Johnson from Novartis, thank you so much for being here. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you.
We really enjoyed the serendipity. Please come back to Science Studio, and thanks to our producer, Dennis Will.
And thank you, the audience out there, for listening, and we shall be back next week with another program. Come back. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The El Paso Diabetes Association is having its 10th annual Faces of Diabetes Conference. It takes place in the El Paso Convention Center on October 25th. Read more at the Region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse is brought to you by Sierra Providence Health Network.